Hi.
Welcome to Drinking the Kool-Aid.
Welcome.
I'm Megan.
I'm Hannah.
And today we've got our part three of Ellen Greenberg. And for this one, I watched Gavin Fish's YouTube videos, listened to the Prosecutor's Podcast five-part series, and I also listened to Big Mad True Crime Podcast. And a recap of part two. The Greenbergs were told that there was a neuropathologist report done on Ellen's spinal cord, and it was the reason that the case was closed and changed to suicide. But the police and the medical examiner didn't have the report, and the forensic pathologist said she didn't do a report and never saw the specimen. The Greenbergs hired their own experts to look through the files, and they all started coming to the same conclusion. Cyril Wecht said, quote, "It is my professional opinion that the manner of death of Ellen Greenberg is strongly suspicious of homicide." Henry Lee said, quote, "The number and type of wounds and bloodstain patterns observed are consistent with a homicide scene." Wayne Ross said, quote, "It is my opinion that the investigating authorities should pursue this case as a homicide. It is further my opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty that the manner of death is a homicide. The scene findings were indicative of a homicide." Gregory McDonald said, quote, "Typically, if a person is stabbing you, they're not going to stab you several times superficially and then stab you deeper. It's possible, but that's one of the things that struck me as not being consistent with homicide." All of these experts are saying this is strongly suspicious of a homicide, yet Marlon Osborne changed her manner of death to a suicide. That's where we ended off in the last one.
You could have just said a bunch of sketchy shit happened, a bunch of professionals believe that it's homicide, and there's only a few people that don't. There we go.
Okay, I'm going to start having you write the recaps then. How's that? If you want the condensed version.
Oh, man.
Perfect.
Oh, man.
So, Tom Brennan was absolutely determined to figure out how on earth Ellen's manner of death was actually switched to a suicide. On September 13th of 2013, a conference call placed from the Dauphin County Coroner's Office to medical examiner officials in Philadelphia seemed to supply some of those answers. On the call was Brennan, the pathologist the Greenbergs hired named Dr. Wayne Ross, and County Coroner Graham Hetrick, who was on the call but never spoke. On the other end of the line was Osborne and his boss, Philadelphia medical examiner Dr. Samuel Gelino. And Brennan was taking notes during the call, and one of the things that he wrote down was, quote, "Dr. Ross began the conversation by asking Dr. Osborne a number of questions related to Dr. Osborne's findings in his autopsy report. Osborne responded to all Dr. Ross's questions, although Dr. Ross did not agree with a number of Dr. Osborne's responses, the call remained congenial." Brennan noted that the tone of the call changed drastically at one point when he said, quote, "I then asked Dr. Osborne why he changed the cause and manner of death from homicide to suicide. Dr. Osborne responded, 'I changed it at the insistence of the police because they said there was a lack of defense wounds.'"
Interesting.
Brennan said, quote, "Since when do the police have anything to do with making a medical decision regarding the cause and manner of death?" Dr. Osborne did not respond, and then the call was ended shortly after this. The next time the Greenbergs team was able to question Dr. Osborne and Dr. Gelino was under oath during the depositions in April of 2021 that were taken for the family's lawsuits against Philadelphia officials, including the pair of pathologists. They were questioned about the undisclosed meeting where they decided to amend Ellen's death certificate. Gelino said, quote, "It occurred in the medical examiner's office in one of our conference rooms." Gelino couldn't recall the exact date that this took place and could not remember which police officers attended, though he did know that the meeting had to have taken place prior to her certificate being amended on April 4th of 2011. So it's like...
So couldn't remember a single thing about it, but it happened.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for providing the specifics.
Awesome.
Great job. Giulino said, quote, "I don't recall who it was that asked me to take part in this meeting. I did not initiate the meeting. What I recall being discussed is that the police wanted to present additional evidence that they felt showed that the death of Ellen Greenberg was a suicide and not a homicide." He was questioned about what evidence was provided, and he said, quote, "The two topics that I remember from that meeting were the absence of defensive cuts on Ellen Greenberg's hands or forearms, and the fact that the door was locked or the lock was engaged from the inside of the apartment."
Both of those bother me.
They do. And it's interesting that he remembers the specific topics that are discussed, but he can't remember the time, the date, or anybody who was involved. Yeah.
But like both of those topics, like both of the things that he pointed out, it just, like, she could have been paralyzed pretty quickly.
Sure.
By some of those stab wounds.
Yeah.
Could have been taken off guard.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to point out, this is not the only case we've done where somehow the door was locked from the inside.
And technically, we don't have proof of that. We only have Sam's word.
Right. No, that's valid too, I guess. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. But like, there is that hotel case too.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
Where the spy?
Like, with the security guard and everything. Where the person was like murdered in the hotel room, but it was like impossible for them to get out.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the one where people believe she's a spy.
Yeah.
All the tags were cut out of her clothing and stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's where you're going with that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it can happen. Doors can be locked. Or...
And it's just crazy that those two little things, though.
Yes.
Are
that
what
they're stuck on.
Yeah, is what they're like, yep, this solidifies it. Like,
right.
What? What?
Yeah. I think there's a lot more pointing in the other direction, but that's just me. I didn't work the case.
Yep.
Osborne said that he had been asked by an officer on at least one other occasion prior to the meeting to change the manner of death, but he couldn't remember which officer this was or the names of the officers who attended the meeting.
Oh my God, dude.
So we've got very, very selective remembering.
Wow.
Here. Yeah.
I mean, for real.
Interesting.
Especially, like, not remembering who is involved, too, because I just, that's...
Somehow he can remember everything people say to him,
right.
Just not who did it.
And it's just very, but it's so weird that you can't remember a single person in there.
Right.
Because, like, I might forget, you know, if I'm, like, sitting in a classroom with people, I'm going to be like, well, I can't remember everyone that's in here, but I'm sure can remember some of the people that were there.
Yeah, you might not rattle off the whole roster, but you can get a couple names in there.
For sure.
But not this guy. Under Pennsylvania law, Osborne was the only person with the power to change Ellen's death certificate. One thing the Greenberg family learned was that the medical examiner's office had kept a key specimen of Ellen's knife-stabbed spinal tissue. And we briefly talked about that in the last episode.
Yes, we did.
8 years after Ellen's investigation had been closed and changed to suicide, the Philadelphia medical examiner asked his recently hired assistant, ME, to examine the specimen. Dr. Lindsay Emery conducted the exam in 2019, but she did not write a report about it. In May of 2021, she communicated her findings verbally to Philadelphia medical examiner Sam Giulino. The tissue she examined came from a deep stab wound to the back of Ellen's neck that likely occurred after her heart had stopped beating. Brennan said that at her deposition, quote, she stated that her examination revealed that the wound lacked hemorrhage. And if it lacked hemorrhage, then what? It lacked pulse. And if it lacked pulse, then the victim was dead. Emery said she was asked by Giulino to perform a, quote, informal curbside exam of the spinal specimen, which lasted 45 minutes to an hour and included her making sections of the specimen to look at under the microscope, and then she also took photos. To place the specimen into proper context with the injuries found at autopsy, she looked at file photos and found, quote, sharp force injury to the bone and ligaments of the back of the spinal column, the vertebral column. The injuries lined up with the damage to the spinal specimen. During the exam, she found, quote, a corresponding cut of the dura that covers the spinal cord. She also found a, quote, 1.1 centimeter defect of the vertebral column itself. She did not find any sign of bleeding from the wounds to the spinal specimen. Quote, there is a defect in the dura that corresponds with the spinal cord or the spinal column injury, but there is no hemorrhage around it. The Greenberg's attorney asked, quote, and by the fact that now the dura is not demonstrating hemorrhage, as you found, also that the spinal column didn't, would that weigh a little more in suggesting that Ellen was dead at the time that this wound was administered? Emery said, quote, yes. So I have all of this evidence that says there is no hemorrhage or reaction to any of these changes in the spinal cord. The attorney said, quote, so what you're saying is Ellen would have been dead when this was administered. Emery said, quote, yeah, I mean, lack of hemorrhage means no pulse.
Okay, well, I would just like to know how a dead girl stabs herself.
Right. That's pretty much a conundrum here, right? I mean, that would be pretty wild.
Really fucking impressive.
I've never heard of that one before.
I haven't either.
We've never covered a case where that's happened. Emery did mention that there is another possible cause for the lack of hemorrhaging in the sample. The blood could have been washed away during the autopsy. This would be far more likely from the dura covering, but far less likely for the spinal column itself. She repeatedly stated that she had no opinion on the manner of death, though. She did mention that typically when she does an exam, she also files a report, but she was not told to file a report in this case.
That is really weird.
It's sketchy. I mean, if protocol says usually we do this, but you're told not to.
So that must be what they meant, like, or what you meant earlier by like informal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do believe that that's what they're getting at here.
Okay.
And Giulino said that she could verbally tell him of her findings and then he would work it into his own report. However, there's no evidence that that ever happened. And the information in the deposition led the Greenbergs to file the second lawsuit where they accused the officials of a cover-up. Did Ellen stab herself? Well, if she did, she was able to keep stabbing despite the pain to inflict 20 wounds that varied in severity. Ellen was 5'7" and weighed 136 pounds. So would she have the strength to push a 10-inch kitchen knife into her own chest, and of course all of the other wounds? The Greenbergs have hired a team of experts that say this was homicide, and they intend to prove it. The evidence they would point to would include a 3D computer analysis of the trajectory and depth of all 20 stab wounds. The analysis was conducted by BioMX Corp., a Virginia-based independent computational biomechanics engineering consulting company that reconstructs accidents and criminal injuries for court cases. I cannot believe I just said that entire sentence.
Whoa. I was already mind blown like a few frigging words into it, and it just kept going.
Whoa. Okay.
Wow.
The report and 3D images and the written conclusions it contained are included in the Greenberg's lawsuits. The process is able to digitize Ellen's autopsy photos, producing a 3D model of her exterior and interior anatomy. Each of her stab wounds are also digitally recreated based on the exact measurements, depths, and placements of each wound that was documented during the autopsy.
That's actually really cool.
It is really awesome that they can do something like this. The kitchen knife that was in her chest was digitized and placed into each wound according to the exact measurements of location, width, and depth. There are more than 40 3D images showing the knife's angle of entry at each wound and the depth the knife's blade reached within her body for each puncture mark.
Yeah, that's bitching, actually.
It is really, really cool to get that visual, to actually see it, because it's different than just hearing, you know, what we're talking about.
Well, not only that, but like having different angles of every, like,
yeah,
wound and every, you know, like every stab wound and everything, because that's just, I mean, that's so freaking helpful.
It is, yeah. And I mean, it would be great for the jury if this was, you know, going to trial. After inputting all of the data for the 3D analysis, the report stated the following, quote, 11 posterior head and neck wounds sustained by Ellen Greenberg are not biomechanically consistent with self-infliction. It says that they are, quote, consistent with focalized stabbing by an assailant. So now we've got a computer, you know, process that's telling us Ellen did not do this to herself. It's not biomechanically possible.
Imagine that.
Mm. The 3D analysis identified two of the posterior stab wounds as being particularly severe. Both were so deep that one penetrated her vertebra, spinal column, and spinal cord, and the other bore into her brain.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So it was really deep. And that's the other thing, okay? Just stopping for a second and thinking about that. If she would have to reach behind herself and get the knife into her head, in the back, into her brain, could she have put that much force into it?
I don't know. Every time, like, you're talking about, like, stab wounds that would have been difficult for her to do, like, I know, like, you mentioned the chest a lot because, like, it's hard for somebody to, like, keep going with that. But, like, I keep thinking about the back one, like, the back of the head ones.
Yes.
That's all I can think about because that right there, like, I, as someone who has a lot of back issues, I have to hold that, like, stupid vibrating gun on my back all the time. And I'm not even kidding. I can only do it for, like, a minute on my own because my entire arm is about to fall off.
It's not
I can hardly
easy.
Do it.
Yeah.
And, like, the angle trying to get it in, like, it's almost impossible.
That's actually a really valid point because I have the same thing. And so I use one on myself all the time, and it's not easy to reach.
No, it truthfully isn't. And it's, like, even if you, it, like, get it for, like, a split second, like, it's impossible to, like, switch the position then. Like, how are you going to tell me that she was pulling the knife back and then sticking it back there with the strength after everything else? And it just doesn't add up to me.
Right. It seems very unlikely.
I just, like, even, like, sitting here doing, like, that's a hard angle.
Right.
That's not easy. I don't know how you would even get the force from that angle on top of that. Like, it just, you just can't move that forcefully like that.
Yeah, and actually, in a little bit, I am going to point everybody to a YouTube video about this as well.
Oh, shit, yes.
Yeah.
I love that.
So the stab wound to the spinal column was the one examined years later by Dr. Lindsay Emery using a spinal specimen, and she had testified that there was a strong possibility Ellen was dead when this blow was struck. The 3D analysis is not able to determine the sequence of the stab wounds, and they were not able to determine this during the autopsy ever either. The only thing that we know for sure is the last wound was in Ellen's chest because the knife was left in there. The 3D analysis can conclude that several of the previous stab wounds, such as the neck injury, would have debilitated Ellen, causing, quote, impaired coordination, semi-consciousness, and unconsciousness, among numerous other physical and mental effects.
And Jesus, like, I keep forgetting, yeah, that the knife was, like, literally in her chest. Like, you're gonna just tell me that she stabbed herself in the fucking brain and then was able to keep going?
Right, exactly. That doesn't make a lot of sense.
That is crazy. Holy.
And the autopsy results and 3D wound analysis show that Ellen sustained a deep stab wound to the brain, and this strike alone could have caused her to lose consciousness. The Greenbergs hired Dr. Wayne Ross, the Lancaster-based neural forensic pathologist who is a court-qualified expert on stab wounds, and he wrote the following about Ellen's brain injury after reviewing the autopsy files. Quote, "There was evidence of a stab wound which penetrated the cranial cavity and severed the cranial nerves in the brain. As a result, Ellen would experience severe pain, cranial nerve dysfunction, and traumatic brain signs and symptoms, including numbness, tingling, irregular heartbeat, bradycardia, respiratory depression, neurogenic shock, and impaired loss of consciousness." How on earth did she stab herself in the chest after all of this?
I mean, truthfully, now she was either dead and stabbed herself, unconscious or still stabbed herself, had no brain function or like less brain function. I mean, like, it's just holy shit.
Right. And I want to point out, this is only focusing on the effects of one stab wound, and she had 20, okay? The 3D model report simulated the severity and effects of each wound, and here is a list of some of the physical effects that she would have suffered. Quote, unconsciousness, cranial nerve defects, severe facial pain, impaired coordination, impaired or loss of vision, seizure, weakness, blood loss of heart rate and blood pressure, hypoxic brain damage, respiratory failure, cardiac dysrhythmia, and loss of cerebrospinal fluid, among other significant and physical damage. Like, holy shit!
I mean, it would truthfully be like nothing short of a miracle if somehow she was able to do that all on her own. I'm just saying.
Well, and this alone, to me, should be enough proof to reinvestigate this case as
That's
a homicide.
Absolutely would push me over. Yeah.
But there's more.
Oh, no.
The 3D analysis of Ellen's autopsy shows multiple bruises on her wrists, right arm, neck, right hip, and both legs. And the report states, quote, multiple contusions of Ellen Greenberg's upper and lower extremities of various resolutions are biomechanically consistent with assailant-oriented trauma and not self-inflicted injury.
Are you fucking kidding me?
So now we've got both things here. The bruises and the stab wounds are not lining up with things that she did to herself. And the police keep saying over and over she doesn't have defensive wounds. Bruising is defensive wounds. What are you talking about?
Right. And again, like we said, like if she was taken off guard.
Yeah.
What if one of the first stab wounds was to the back of the head? Well, you're not going to be able to do much at that point. I mean, if you got stabbed in the fucking brain.
Right.
Like, what if that was one of the first ones?
We don't know. Immediately unconscious, you know?
Like, shit.
Right. And Tom Brennan wonders if the bruising suggests that maybe somebody was holding her wrists or ankles at some point.
Right. Or even could have been, like, leaning on them when they were, like, stabbing her.
Sure. There's a number of scenarios here that we're not even looking at because it wasn't investigated that way.
It's just mind-blowing to me because, like, I get it. It's not an easy thing to just, like, open up a case again. But, like, when you've got this much screaming in your face to maybe look into it a little bit more. Like, come on, do better.
And I know that if they change this one, there's going to be a whole bunch of cases coming down their way saying, hey, guess what? We've been trying to get these opened forever. Now we can cite this one. And I get it. You don't want that caseload, but sorry, you need to do your job.
And yes, exactly. There are lots of times, too, that things have been fucked up.
Of course.
And they should be fixed.
They should. You can't just be like, well, sorry, it was fucked up. Guess it stays as is. That's not fair.
Nope.
Cyril Wecht, had also written in his report about those bruises and stated, quote, multiple contusions in various stages of resolution were present on the upper and lower extremities. Dr. Ross wrote that the bruising on her neck was, quote, evidence of strangulation. He said, quote, there was a mark over the front of the neck which was consistent with a fingernail mark. There were multiple bruises under the neck and in the strap muscles over the right side of the neck. He felt that, quote, the patterns were compatible with a manual strangulation. Tom Brennan also agreed with this and said that during an autopsy, they take the skin from in front and they flip it up so that they can view the esophagus.
God, that wording.
Sorry.
They take the skin and they flip it up.
Yeah.
All right.
In Ellen's autopsy, she had hemorrhaging in her throat, which, in his opinion, was proof of manual strangulation. To show both sides, though, Cyril Weck's report did not mention neck bruising or the possibility of manual strangulation. Ellen did have several fresh bruises, but she also had numerous old bruises at various stages of healing. They were located on her torso, arm, and both legs. Ross wrote in his report that, quote, the patterns are consistent with a repeated beating. I also want to mention that these areas of the body would be really easy to hide with clothing.
Oh, yeah.
So if she was being abused by someone,
yep,
that could explain why other people did not know about it. I mean, people that are abusers often do know how to bruise you in areas that are easily hideable.
It's because they've been doing it for a while.
Exactly. Like, this isn't their first rodeo. They know what's up. Cyril Weck's report mentioned the bruises, but he did not come to any conclusions about this. Her parents wonder if this bruising could explain why Ellen suddenly suffered from anxiety and wanted to leave Philadelphia. They later learned from a family friend that Ellen was preparing to leave the day she died.
Okay. Are you fucking kidding me?
I mean, that was in one of the reports. So I don't know, because I don't think it was something that was documented like through a text or anything where we can say like, hey, this is glaring proof. But if she was planning to leave that day, and then all of a sudden that blizzard came in, maybe kind of preventing things, she could have already said, hey, I don't want to do this anymore. And now she has to go back to that apartment.
Yep.
It's possible. Her father, Josh Greenberg, said, quote, we're just moving up a legal ladder. It's a very tough, frustrating life, and it's very disappointing who we are fighting. He accused the city of trying to wait him out or bleed him dry financially, and he said, quote, the city's job to postpone, procrastinate, and make excuses, it's a stall. They're hoping I die or run out of money. He is furious about the way that things have gone with the police, and he said, quote, I hope these people see my daughter bleeding in pain every time they look at a child. That's what we have to face. That's what we see. It should haunt them forever and ever if they have any kind of conscience.
That is heartbreaking.
It is, because, I mean, of course, they just want justice for their daughter. This is ridiculous. The Greenbergs say that their goal of winning justice for their daughter imbued their golden years with deeper meaning. Joshua said, this has given us a purpose and a mission. When I think about stopping this mission, I get sick. He says, quote, our way of enjoying the holiday season is doing whatever we can to get justice for our daughter. When it comes to a family holiday, there's a hole in our heart, just like an empty seat at the table where our daughter should be. Sandy told Dateline, quote, my daughter did not commit suicide. We've grieved her life for years. Now we want to clear her name. We want justice for her and we want closure.
Yes.
And trust me, through everything that I've read and seen, they are going to continue this fight.
Good.
In October of 2019, the Greenbergs' attorney, Joseph Pedraza Jr., filed a civil lawsuit on their behalf against the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's Office and the pathologist who conducted the autopsy to get the officials to change Ellen's manner of death from suicide to undetermined or back to homicide. In January of 2020, the judge ruled that the case could move forward, but the court proceedings were on hold due to the coronavirus pandemic.
No!
Yeah. The case did start moving again in 2021 after months of pretrial testimony and media coverage. The Greenbergs' attorney said that on December 10th of 2021, his team provided, quote, numerous additional materials to the AG's office in response to the AG's statement to the press that the AG would review new material if the material was supplied, and to clarify, AG is Attorney General.
Oh, okay, got it.
I just wanted to make sure.
Egg? Yeah, that's what I thought.
Oh, okay.
They're just the eggs.
Yeah, the eggs.
Yeah.
They had, yep, that's what they were dealing with.
Yep.
The materials submitted included the apartment building surveillance video, the declarations of two building employees, and the videotaped depositions of Dr. Giulino, Dr. Osborne, and Dr. Emery of the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's Office. Once this was submitted, the Greenbergs requested that Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro review and reopen the case. He did not respond to any questions from Dateline, but a spokesperson confirmed that they received the new evidence and it was being reviewed. I do want to re-go over the timeline of how things happened and kind of give you a little more in depth on that. So on the day before Ellen's death, she texted her mom and her mom told her that she needed to see a professional. And Ellen said, okay, I'm trying, just scared of it for everything. On the day of her death, the two of them talked at 7 a.m. and they had a pleasant conversation. Ellen's class let out early due to that blizzard, and then she gassed up her car at 1:30 p.m. Now, was that strictly out of habit? Or was she looking towards the future and did not want to end her life that day?
Yeah, it is. That is strange.
I mean, it's possible that she, you know, had it in her head and just gassed it up, you know, because that's what she does. But
okay, yes, why? But also, like, when I'm driving home from work or like from something else, and I tend to automatically or I tend to, you know, get gassed at like similar times and similar days, to be honest, and like, I've many times been like, if I'm too stressed, I'm driving home and I'm like, oh my God, blah, 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 my head is just going a million miles a minute. And then all of a sudden I like pass the gas station. I'm like, oh shit. So like, even like though I was still gonna go, like just because I have so much on my mind, and I feel like if you were driving home to do something like that, that just wouldn't be something that you would have as even a habit or priority. I just feel like your brain wouldn't be working like that.
Also, there was a blizzard coming, and I know for me, if I'm trying to beat the blizzard and get my ass home really quickly, I'm not stopping for gas.
Very true.
It's not happening.
Yep.
So to me, that's another thing, though, that points to she wasn't planning on her life ending that day.
Well, maybe she was gassing up to leave.
She could have been. Yeah. At 2:30 p.m., she called a restaurant, and I'm not entirely clear on this. We don't know if she was trying to order something, make a reservation, or even cancel a reservation. She was planning a big dinner party for Sam's birthday, and I don't know if this restaurant has anything to do with that. I couldn't find anything, which to me was a little odd. But maybe that means investigators did not contact this restaurant to find out. I don't know.
So there's like nothing more to it. It's just she called the restaurant.
She called the restaurant. Yeah.
Okay.
I assume she wasn't placing an order because they would have showed up with the food.
Right.
That would have been on record, you know?
Yeah, I don't know.
So I really don't know what happened there. At 4:46, Ellen's computer was used for the last time. At 4:50, Sam left the apartment and headed to the gym located in the apartment complex. The key fob records show that he did enter the gym at 4:54, and he was also caught on camera. He got back to the apartment just after 5:30, and the calls from Sam to Ellen registered between 5:30 and 5:42, and then the series of text messages that he sent to her were between 5:32 and 5:54. If you believe that Ellen took her own life during this 40-minute window, that's a really tight timeline. She was in the middle of cutting up fruit. There were washed blueberries in a strainer and a sliced orange on the counter. She just lost it in the middle of preparing a snack? Or did the two of them have a fight and she thought, enough is enough? If you believe that scenario, why didn't any neighbors hear them fighting? They were able to hear Sam shouting at the door to be let in. If Ellen was ending her own life, how did she complete everything before Sam got back to the door? So it's not even a 40-minute window anymore. It would have to be before he gets to the door.
Well, not only that, but then, like, if the neighbors weren't hearing stuff, like, she would have to be, like, stabbing herself silently.
Right. Not even crying out in pain.
That, I feel like, is almost I feel like that would just be impossible.
You would think so, yeah. And according to his story, the swing bar latch was engaged, meaning the door could be opened a few inches. And according to the reports, you can see into the kitchen where her body was. Why didn't he hear or see her stabbing herself?
That is a great question.
So she was already completely done with this whole thing by the time he got to the door and tried to open it? I mean, that's fast. For all those stab wounds.
I mean, like, really fast.
I mean, she would have had to immediately, the second that he walked out that door and headed to the gym, she would have had to start. Sam went down and spoke to the security guard after he couldn't get into the door, okay? Into the apartment. And the guard called Ellen's phone at 6:07 and 6:10. And now this is where their stories differ. Sam says that after he talked to the security guard, the two of them went to the apartment and Sam broke down the door. The security guard says, no, no, no. He never left his post that day. He flat told Sam it's against their policy to break down the door. He was not seen on surveillance video leaving his post to go with him. And he also mentioned that he thought it was really strange that Sam kept telling him that he had been at the gym.
Because, like, repetitively being like, oh, I was at the gym and this happened and I was just at the gym.
Well, when he was saying it, the security guard noticed that Sam wasn't wearing sneakers. He had boots on.
Oh, whoops.
So it's like, okay, why are you going to the gym with big old boots on?
And you could say, like, oh, I'd switch shoes, but that doesn't make any sense when you live in the freaking apartments.
Exactly. He didn't leave. It was in the apartment complex, like downstairs. Also, if he was there, why was the security guard not heard on the 911 call? Like, did he just go in, look at the scene, see a dead woman's body on the floor and say, okay, gotta go, bye?
Right.
That makes no sense. And during the 911 call, the operator asked Sam if anybody else was there, and he said no. So that's not gonna work.
Whoops.
And Sam didn't just go back up to the apartment and break the door down like he said either. At 6:14, he allegedly called Kamian Schwartzman, which is his first cousin and good friend. At 6:26, Sam allegedly answered a call from his uncle, James Schwartzman, who is a prominent attorney and judge. According to Gavin
that's a quinkidink.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. That would be very, very strange if that happened.
Yep.
But I cannot say for sure. However, I have heard it elsewhere and seen it in documents. Allegedly.
Okay.
According to Gavin Fish's YouTube video, he's the kind of judge that makes sure other lawyers remain ethical. Now, if he did contact him, why would he contact an attorney before entering that apartment? Why waste time if you think Ellen is actually in danger? Do you know who he didn't contact? Anybody that Ellen could possibly know. He didn't call her parents. He didn't call her friends. He didn't call anyone to see if they knew where Ellen actually was. He was positive she was in that apartment. Why?
That is a great question.
And you could say, well, because it was locked, so he had to know she was inside. But if he is calling her, emailing her, texting her, shouting her name, banging on the door, and she's not answering, why do you think she's in that apartment?
Yeah.
It's a little strange.
I guess I hadn't really thought about that.
And you could say, okay, well, there was a blizzard, so where could she go? Well, he went to the gym. Is there nowhere else in this apartment that she could go?
Right.
I mean, I looked at some photos of the apartment complex, and it looks fairly large. Like, there are other rooms and areas to go. Now, if he did call his cousin, Kamian, what did he say on that phone call that prompted Kamian to turn around and contact his attorney father and have him reach out to Sam?
And see, that's what I was like, as soon as you mentioned that he was an attorney, I was like, wait, what?
Yeah, and I mean...
Why? I mean, that would just be way too much of a coincidence.
Yes.
If they just happened to be calling that exact moment.
Is it weird timing that right after this call, Sam allegedly broke down the door at 6:30 and found Ellen?
Yeah. That, yeah.
Now, I do want to say it's often reported that Sam was the one that called his attorney uncle, but according to the prosecutor's podcast and Gavin Fish, it isn't true. He called his cousin, Kamian, allegedly, and he had James Schwartzman, allegedly, call Sam.
Okay.
If the door was locked and Sam was calling Ellen's name and calling her phone, why would he be so positive she's inside? It is very possible for that swing latch to lock on its own if the door is shut hard enough. If the lock isn't pushed all the way against that door frame and it's opened even a little bit, it can accidentally lock. This is extremely common. In fact, I brought this up to my parents and they were like, that just happened to us.
No shit.
Okay. So they said that they went to a hotel and that swing lock latch closed on them, so they couldn't open the door and they had to go to the front desk. And when they did, they were like, oh, it's not a problem. It happens all the time. So this is extremely common.
Now that I think about it, it's actually happened to me before.
And okay, I don't want to give people ideas, so I like hate saying this, but my dad said that he walked back up with the security guard or the maintenance or whoever went up with him, and they used a wire hanger to pop it open.
Girl, I told you that.
Yeah, so...
It's so fucking easy to open those locks, dude. I'm not even kidding. Even the ones that are, like, angled so that you're, like, it's not supposed to open, you just have to open the door the right amount.
Yeah.
And then you have to just start sliding it around that thing and then shut it a tiny bit. Push it and it'll pop right the fuck open. It's not difficult.
And I will say, probably for people like you with smaller hands, it might be a little easier. So probably a guy or somebody with thicker, bigger hands, maybe it's not as simple as using fingers. But again, then you can use a hanger or whatever else you have.
I always forget I have child hands.
You do. When Sam entered the apartment, he saw Ellen's bloody body on the floor of the kitchen with her head and shoulders propped against the cabinets. He called 911 at 6:33 p.m. The last call from Sam to Ellen was at 5:52 p.m. and the last text from Sam to Ellen was at 5:54 p.m. So there's a 29-minute gap before calling 911. He calls 911 at 6:33, and 1 minute later, allegedly, his cousin Kamian arrived at the apartment. What did he say that would make Kamian rush to the apartment?
That is very sketch.
Because, I mean, at this point, before he had gone into the apartment, all he knew was that their door was locked. I don't know about you, but if my friend calls and says, like, hey, my door is locked at the apartment, I'd be like, okay, go get a security guard.
Right.
Why are you calling me?
And, like, even if somebody called me, like, panicking about it, like, freaking out, like, I'm locked out.
I'll talk you through it.
Yeah, well, and I'd be like, you know, if you need me, definitely let me know. But, like, try to figure it out for a little bit. If you can't figure it out, call me and I'll head over there and I'll help you.
But I'm sure not going to, like, fly my ass over there.
Exactly.
I think you're going to be okay. That's not an emergency. And the reason I'm actually harping on this specific point is because Sam's text messages did not even sound worried. In fact, when he was texting Ellen, he sounded a little bit like he was threatening her in a way. So if he's not worried when he's texting her, why did Kamian and his father have to go to the apartment? Like, there does need to be an explanation for that piece of it.
That's valid.
Ellen's mom heard the 911 call, and she said that she was shocked by how calm Sam was, and she thought it was odd that he mentioned that he was at the gym before finding her. I also found that odd. However, a 911 operator analyzed the call on one of the podcasts that I listened to and mentioned that it's actually not strange, and people will give their entire life story before answering questions. So I thought it was good to add that perspective in.
I suppose that makes sense, actually.
Yeah, I mean, when you're in a panic, you just start going through everything. It's coming out, you know.
Wow, every 911 operator I've ever had is, like, completely cut me off before I even get to tell them what's happening. So they're just like, give me the address, give me this. And I'm like, okay, but, like, can I just, like, and they're like,
sure.
So I never even get that chance.
You got, like, the professionals.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Maybe.
I'm not going to lie. I've had some really fucking rude operators, to be honest.
Sure.
So it's kind of unfortunate because, like, that should be more of a job for, like, really, like, patient people.
I can't imagine how stressful that job is. I remember I wanted to be a 911 operator.
Yeah. Yes.
I wanted to so bad.
Yeah.
It just didn't work.
It would definitely be a lot for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not good at maps.
Oh, yeah. I suppose there's that too.
Yeah. That was, like, the reason it just wasn't going to work.
It would be like it being left open-ended for me. After taking a call and then it being open-ended and me not knowing, like, the results of it.
That would
take me the fuck down.
Yeah, I get it. When the paramedics arrived at 6:36, Sam was waiting in the hallway. Ellen was declared dead at 6:40 p.m. and the police arrived shortly after this. So the building manager led them up to the apartment. Both the police and the medical examiner wrote in their reports at the scene that Sam said that the doorman slash security guard was with him when he broke down the door, but we know that is not true. He was alone when he broke down the door. Unfortunately, there are no cameras in the hallway, so we can't even verify if the door was locked, like Sam said. He did ask for help opening the door, but what if it wasn't locked?
And it was just chilling, yeah.
This is something that people have wondered if that piece of the story isn't true either. Now, if that's the case, I do want to say that's risky. Like, if he went to the security guard and said, hey, my door is locked, I need help breaking it down, what if the security guard agreed? Like, what would he do?
Well, I mean, yeah, at that point, wouldn't you just be like, I've already tried it a million times, just to help me get it open, like, so he doesn't actually go up and try it. I don't know.
I mean, that could, you'd be in a really weird situation.
Like, unless he kind of, like, maybe knew that they're not supposed to leave their post.
Yeah, that's possible, too, that's against the rules to break it down. Sure. Now, the swing latch is slightly, ever so slightly bent, and the screws are partially out. But to me, it looks very staged. Personal opinion. If the door isn't broken, at the very least, I would expect to see that swing latch broken. If it wasn't even torn off the door frame, I mean, everything was still intact.
Can I say what it looks like to me?
Yes, please.
It looks like he it looks like somebody slammed something just into the front of it, standing in front of the door, right? Facing that lock, it looks like somebody just tried to slam something into it, and that's why the screws are kind of loose. And they just slam something into it real quick, and they're like, okay, cool. Now it looks like I kicked it from the outside.
See, and I didn't even see any damage on the door itself. When I looked at the latch, it was somebody had maybe used their palm to press on it.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
A little bit. Yeah. And that's why the screws are slightly out.
Right. It just looks like somebody just smushed something into it, or smacked it with something or something like that to just get the screws out a teensy bit to make it look like, oh, it's been damaged while we were coming in type deal.
Yeah. And so Gavin Fish did a video where he installed a swing latch on his office door. And he mentioned that he didn't want to cause damage to the door or the frame because it's in his house. So he did not tighten the screws all the way. He tried a couple times to bust through the door with light force, but it didn't budge. So when he actually put effort into it, the door frame completely broke off and the swing bar latch was still attached to that broken door frame. Which is exactly like we expected to see.
His poor door frame.
I know. He was like, it just busted. Now, this isn't exact science. I do understand that. But it did exactly what we expect. When you break down a door, the door gets broken.
Right.
I mean, that's what we thought would happen. The security guard made an official statement that he was the only person at the desk working security on the afternoon of January 26th of 2011, and he confirmed that Sam went to the first floor of the apartment building and said that he could not get into his apartment. The guard confirmed that he never escorted him, and nobody else escorted him to his apartment either. He said that if he had gone to Sam's apartment, he would have used the elevator or the stairs. The security cameras confirm that the security guard did not go with Sam, nor did anyone else. He said that he did not see Sam at the apartment and he did not witness anything that he did on the sixth floor that day. So we definitely know that piece of the story is not correct.
This poor security guard is just trying to live his damn life.
I know, just doing his job. And he's like, why am I getting dragged into this? But, I mean, it does bother me that the statement to the police and to the medical examiner, is that, hey, the security guard was with me when I broke down the door.
It is weird.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing to say.
It sure is. It's going to raise some red flags. And that, again, is okay, if he's lying, then isn't that something we should start to look into? Because if Ellen did this to herself, why would there be any lies?
Right, exactly. I mean, no matter what, why would he even say? It just doesn't make sense. That little piece doesn't fit.
Right. So, you know what? I think that it's in the fourth one where I have it, so I'll bring it up because you were talking about Ellen's stab wounds and how difficult it'll be. So I'll bring it up again. However, I do want to mention that was another YouTube video that Gavin Fish did.
Yes, and I want to actually watch that because I'm very intrigued by that, to be honest with you.
And it does give a really interesting perspective, but yeah, I'll cover it more in the next one.
I'm just I'm very, very intrigued about that because I'm hyper flexible and I still am that it would just be an uncomfortable position. I just to reach back like that. It's weird.
Yeah, exactly.
not that like comfort would have been a thing at that point, but just even the ability with, like, you know, yeah.
Why would you go for areas that are super awkward versus something that you can like easily reach if you're trying to get it over with quickly? Right. Like, that's just going to draw things out if you can't reach very well.
Exactly.
You know? So we'll stop this one here. And next week, we're going to hear the 911 call.
What?
Yeah.
We get to hear it?
Oh, for sure.
Oh, badass.
Yeah, I'll find a way to loop it in.
Yes. I love when I get to, like, hear and, like, see parts of it. It makes it stick so much.
Yeah. And that'll give you, you know, more interesting facts about it.
Yes, and I would love to hear his voice, too.
Yes.
Like, during all of this.
Mm-hmm. So we'll do that. The medical examiner was reprimanded for other cases, and it's an unsettling number of issues that were discovered.
Great.
We will talk about the knife wounds and the positions that it would have been in. And we're going to discuss the reasons that this could be suicide and the reasons this could be homicide.
Okay.
So, there you go.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, make sure to follow us on any of your podcast apps. Tell us the stories you want to hear. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Leave us a 5-star review if you love us. Tell your friends. Tell your cats. Bye.